1979, your comments come across somewhat like a Stephen King novel.
Yes. Which monster is about to arrive, huh?
Yeah, exactly. And back then, we had spiraling inflation, and this is completely the opposite of that. And back then at that time, too, people used to talk about the change in demographics and having been born at the peak of the baby boom. How much do you take that into account relative to other countries who've been through the same sort of rollover in their economy and demographics and what they've had to do?
Well, to paraphrase the question, it really relates to how much we take into consideration demographic changes. And, of course, the gentleman is referring to the baby boom bubble that's coming through. I'm on the front edge of the baby boom, so I usually say to young employed people, I am your worst nightmare personified, because I qualify in 3 years for Social Security, Medicare, and you'll be paying for it. We take into consideration population growth and the necessity of population growth to continue to have a growing economy. And we contrast our situation, or at least compare our situation, to other countries that have had either deflationary episodes or very, very slow economies where their population is not growing and they have the problem of aging. So that's point number one. Point number two, which I, in a way, indirectly referenced in my remarks, there is concern about the fiscal situation of the country, and that is contributing to the uncertainty that, as I laid out, is perhaps helping to slow down investment and slow consumption that we need at this time in the economy. And that fiscal situation has many elements, but among the most important elements are the entitlement spending that will come with the baby boomer generation coming into eligibility. And that really is going to begin in the next few years. So it's not my role to really comment much on the fiscal situation, but it's clearly understood by everybody. We have to tackle that entitlement spending problem that's coming along. Yes, sir.
I'm very nervous about our fiat currency and the fact that you can print money. And I know what it's done in Germany and places like that. And I'm really very fearful of that. My question to you is, if inflation does take off, how do you get all the money back out of circulation?
Thank you for that question. Let me respond in two ways. First, the question was, the gentleman said he is nervous about fiat money. I'll explain what that is. And then if inflation does take off, or if, to put it in a little bit finer terms, if inflation expectations accelerate or grow greater, how will we get that money out of the system? First, fiat money is not money that's based on an Italian sports car. It means money that is issued by a government, and it is worth what the government puts it out to be and the market dictates. It has nothing backing it, per se. We've had a fiat money system now for decades. The alternative was something that was abandoned a long time ago, and that was the gold standard, backing money by a physical commodity, the supply of which can change with consumption or with mining, quite literally. So we are in a fiat money system, and it depends upon the competence and the commitment of monetary authorities to ensure that it does not lose value at any rate more than what we're trying to achieve, which I said is above 1%. I would say, generally speaking, speaking really for myself, between 1.5% to 2% is a healthy rate of inflation. How are we going to get the liquidity out of the system? We have worked a great deal on that and have developed a number of tools to do that. And just a few months ago, that was the issue of the moment, so-called exit strategy from this large balance sheet that was required to respond to the financial crisis. And I don't want to go into great technical terms, but there were three or four ways designed and tested to drain reserves from the financial system, which would have the effect of shrinking and responding to heightened inflation expectations or any other sign of inflation. We might very well drain reserves simply because the economy is picking up steam and the right amount of money in the system needs to be recalibrated. So those are all aspects of the question that you ask. The methods include purchasing or selling securities into the market and taking money out in various forms. They include what are called term deposits of bank reserves. I'm not sure you really want me to go through all of them, but let me assure you that the tools to exit this policy have been designed and have been largely tested and I think stand ready when the time comes. Ironically, the situation has turned dramatically. So the inflation rate is lower than we would like, and the economy is operating at a very low rate of growth. So for the moment, at least, it's a different problem. Yes, sir.
How do you think the dollar reserve currency status affects national security? I know that's not really that's more of a personal question.
Do you want the 1 minute answer or the 1 hour answer? I'll give you the 1 minute or the 2 minute answer. The question is, how does the status of the dollar as the world's foremost reserve currency affect national security? And I actually gave a talk on that very subject. So I think it's a very good question just a few weeks ago. Well, the fact that the dollar is the foremost reserve currency, it's about 61% of official reserves around the world, means that there's always the potential that a foreign government or a foreign owner of those reserves could make some decision that would affect the value of the currency and could, in theory at least, could create an exchange crisis that would make our economy more, it would cause difficulty for our economy, reduce tax receipts with a shrinking economy, and conceivably ultimately affect what the federal government can afford to spend on national security. The situation of a government expressing its views through someone else's currency is not unprecedented. The Suez Crisis in 1957 was a situation in which, interestingly, the United States government did not back the British pound or the British government's invasion of the Suez Canal. And what happened in that set of circumstances is the British government pretty much had to back down and withdraw from their military exercise of trying to reclaim the Suez Canal. So the situation isn't unprecedented. I think it's very far-fetched that such a thing is likely to happen, or that the dollar will lose much of its position in the near term as a reserve currency. I do, however, expect a gradual reduction in the dollar's role as the rest of the world diversifies and some new currencies become qualified to be held as reserve currencies. But I think this is a gradual process. Yes, sir.
I have a two-part question. I think I heard you say that you felt that the current slowdown is temporary. And if you believe it's temporary, what do you think is going to cause the turnaround? Second part is I think you outlined three arguments before the Federal Reserve. I would gravitate towards the second.
Uncertainty?
Yes. Well, the restructuring.
The restructuring of... Okay.
And what would you gravitate towards, and what do you think the Federal Reserve ultimately will gravitate towards?
Well, let me respond to the second question first, because it's easy to deal with. I'm not prepared today to give you an answer. That's really what I'm going to be studying over the next few weeks. And I think all of these arguments have merit, but we have to get into the whatever underlying research can tell us about the real truth and dynamics that work in these, in all three arguments. So I laid them out to give you a sense of this debate that is coming to a head, but not because I'm prepared at this stage to take a position. Some of my colleagues have taken a position, they have recommended particular approaches, but at this point, I'm still neutral on the subject. Now, the first part of the question relates to, if I believe that this is temporary, what's going to bring us along? First, I think with the passage of each week and month of in the absence of any particular shock to the economy, any surprise that comes out of the blue, we will see growing confidence. We're already beginning to see, for example, announced mergers and acquisitions that represent major investments by companies. And I think if people just get used to the idea that we're just gradually improving, that itself will affect consumer confidence and also business confidence. For better or for worse, I think the election on November 2nd will at least clarify one thing that's contributing to uncertainty, although the policies that ensue from that may not be clear. At least who controls houses of Congress and so forth will be clarified. And I also think that after the election, some of the issues that have contributed to the weight of uncertainty will at least be addressed. Maybe not resolved, but at least addressed. Also, I think the data that we're seeing is mixed. It's not uniformly negative. There are elements that remain positive. We are, after all, growing. So I'm hopeful we'll see some improving data in certain areas that also will add up to a more positive view. I'll remind you of the first half of the year and the crazy things that happened that were so unexpected. Some of these had to weigh on confidence. Things that you just couldn't predict. A volcano erupts and shuts down air traffic in Europe for several days. And then an oil spill comes along, and one of my directors, who's the CFO of Home Depot, she's actually the chairman, said that after the well was capped, traffic in Home Depot stores rose pretty dramatically in the weekend after. That told me that people were sort of holding back because one more unusual piece of news just would be enough to stop spending. And so I'm just hoping that in the second half of the year there are no shocks that come, no surprises, and we'll just see gradual recognition that we are in recovery.
Two more questions.
Certainly one of the Bryans deserves a question here.
This is a high school English teacher, Brian. I sense a certain delight to some degree on your part in the wordsmithing and the diction of a statement like that. And I'm curious what light you could shine on the process of crafting that statement, of the group process, of how that goes about to get it right, knowing how much does Q and what an impact that's going to have.
The question relates to the FOMC statement. I hope everyone detected my tongue totally in cheek when I said that this is a form of literature, but it is a form of writing that takes a little bit of work. There is a big, big emphasis on being consistent with past statements. So the history has some influence on how you're going to say something going forward. For example, we have been in the statement expressing the view that the federal funds target rate will remain at a low level for an extended period for months and months now. I think it was December 2008 that language began to be used. So there is an element of being careful about changing the language. Secondly, we obviously tried to state things as accurately as possible that reflects the consensus of the committee. So in the first paragraph that tries to characterize the economy, there's a lot of discussion at the table of the economy, and we try to craft language that captures really the way the economy looks at the moment and the outlook from that point. The staff, Board of Governors staff, prepares statements, mock-ups, and then we work from that. So we don't just sit around and start from absolute scratch every time. And then, as I said, we're careful about the expected market reaction to words that change from meeting to meeting. That gives you a flavor for it. Thanks, everyone, for your attention. I appreciate it. Thank you.